So just before the break, I said that we have to fix our loop around which we calculate the holonomy in order to calculate the field strength to the lowest non-zero eigenvalue of the area operator in full theory. This gives us restriction, the constraint which couples the parameter, the translation parameter, which encodes the length of the edge around which we calculate the holonomy, the triad component, and exactly this lowest non-zero eigenvalue, which numerical value is known. However, I just haven't written it here. In consequence, the shift value, lambda, will be function of mu. Therefore, it won't be constant function on the phase space. That gives some additional difficulty.
Question?
Sure.
What's the motivation for
doing? Motivation for what?
What's the motivation for doing?
Motivation for doing so is. That's right. No, the problem is that, as far as I understand the full theory, the geometric area operator is supposed to measure some kind of area with respect to physical metric, which is given, right? Therefore, if we calculate also, we cannot take the limit with area of the loop going to zero, because then we just shrink to the point and we won't be able to calculate anything like this. So the point is we have to take the lowest non-zero eigenvalue, which is given by the operator corresponding to physical area. Therefore, we have to compare the physical area of our loop, which comes from the, which is determined by the parameters we are using in symmetry reduced theory, to the lowest non-zero eigenvalue of the area operator. Maybe I don't understand completely your question. You mean changing the lapse function? Or? Which one? Field strength operator? Okay. So? Yeah, but the, how it affects the construction of this? That's something I cannot understand. Okay. Okay, so as I said, the shift will be now the function of configuration variable. In consequence, we'll have a little bit, we have to take a little bit of care when we want to calculate the action of the operator, of the shift operator corresponding to almost periodic functions. Because now the lambda is a function of configuration variable. So let's consider for a moment the standard Schrödinger representation. L square, there should be square here, L square of over the real line with standard measure. If we have any displacement value k, the operator exponents of ikc by 2 just drags the state along the vector field k d by d mu. So of course, operator d by d mu is well defined in this representation. It's not well defined in our representation in which we are working. However, the family of diffeomorphisms, which is generated by d by d mu, has well-defined action also in our kinematical Hilbert space, which is, again, space of square integrable functions over Bohr compactification of real line. Therefore, we are allowed to write our action of the n function as follows, and then ask about the affine parameter corresponding to the flow of these vector fields, vector field. And we can calculate this affine parameter easily, just using the standard equation d lambda of mu d by d mu is supposed to be equal to some d by dv. This is very simple equation, which we can solve. And the result is as follows. Affine parameter is equal to some fundamental numerical constant times sine of mu times absolute value of mu to power 3 half. Once we did so, we can observe that operator P is diagonal also if we start. Okay, we don't really change the representation. We can relabel our mu states using values of V. So right now we can describe ket mu as ket V, where V is related with mu by this formula. Therefore, since this is a fine parameter of our vector flow, action of this holonomy in this basis will be very simple. This exponent, this is not lambda times mu, this is lambda as function of mu. I lambda as function of mu times c by 2, acting on, this shouldn't be here, acting on psi of v, just shift psi of v by 1. In consequence, we can quantize everything. We can express holonomies in terms of these n operators corresponding to almost periodic functions. We can operator V, which corresponds to the volume of the fiducial cell, when acting on mu state gives just P to 3 half times mu. So our basis is still our basis states are also eigenstates of the volume operator. We can raise the Poisson brackets to commutators. Exactly the same modification, the same changes we can apply here to this expression. We can gather it together. And calculate the final form of the gravitational constraint. what can be used as the eraser? Thanks. Okay. It's a little bit unstable. Thanks. So, classically, classically, our Hamiltonian constraint after applying the fact that we cannot shrink everything to zero, just to lowest non-zero eigenvalue of the array operator, will be the limit of this, where this, of course, this would be when we shrink everything to zero, this would be exact. But we can write it as C. Wait a moment. Okay, classically, as I said, exactly, Hamiltonian constraint will be just limit of particular component of particular expression when area of the square loop used to construct the field strength operator goes to zero. This component is equal to minus 4 sine of P over 8 pi gamma cube lambda cube G sum over I j k epsilon I j k trace. Then we have holonomies which compose our closed loop, ij lambda hj hi lambda to minus 1, hj lambda to minus 1, times part which comes from the product of triads, hk lambda Poisson bracket hk lambda to minus 1 with volume. And now we can re-express the holonomies in terms of shift operators corresponding to almost periodic functions. Sine lambda c minus 4 over 8 pi g gamma cube sine of p over lambda cube sum over k trace of tau k h k lambda h lambda k to minus 1 v. Yeah, times again sine lambda c. Point is that if we want, have we preserved the exact factor ordering which was present here, these signs should be gathered together on the left-hand side of this expression. However, we know that once we go to the quantum theory, we always have some factor ordering ambiguity. So we have chosen factor ordering in which the resulting operator after quantization will be symmetric. Now, once we apply all the techniques I discussed a few minutes ago, I mean, if we remember, if we remember that our lambda is given by the lowest non-zero eigenvalue of the array operator, if we switch to the basis V corresponding to the affine parameter of the shift operators, then we can calculate the operator, the quantum operator corresponding to gravitational part of the constraint. This will be again sine lambda c by lambda c, some operator A, this raised to the operator sine lambda c, also raised to the operator, where A is 24i over 8 pi gamma cube lambda cube Planck length square sine lambda c by 2, again operator, volume operator, cosine lambda c by 2 operator minus cosine exchanged with sine. Of course, we have to remember that sine, for example, cosine is just 1/2 E2 of lambda C E2 I lambda C plus E2 minus I lambda C. Therefore, each operator corresponding to psi and cosine this way can be expressed in terms of our capital N operators. And once we do it, our A operator will observe that our A operator will have extremely simple form. Minus 27k, where k is exactly the constant coming from the affine parameter, over 4, 8 pi over 6, Planck length over gamma 2, 3 half, where gamma is Barbeau-Mirzi parameter, times absolute value of V, and some kind of funny difference. We changed the basis to V. Okay. This is V. So this operator is again diagonal. Moreover, we observe that if we are farther from the V equal to 0 point than, say, 1, this will be always the value of V greater than 1 implies that this is equal to 2, right? Yeah. This operator is unbounded, right? This operator is, no. It's not unbounded because it's absolute value of V here. So this is bounded. Yeah, it's more precisely, it is positively definite. Okay, this part is positively definite since there is a minus. It's positively, it's negatively definite, and it's symmetric because it's diagonal. Now, since we have both signs on both sides of the operator, we'll see that this operator has to be also symmetric and positively definite. So this is exactly the argument by which this is the exact reason why we have chosen this particular factor ordering at the classical level. Once we express these signs in terms of n lambda operators, the final form is very simple. CG, when acting on some function of V, can be expressed. Oops, something funny happened. Something wrong with fonts. Okay. Transfer from tag file to PDF sometimes does funny things with particular expressions. G on some small psi of V can be written as psi C plus, which is some function of V psi of V plus 4 plus some C naught of V psi of V plus C minus of V psi V minus 4, where C plus of V is equal to 27 over 16, 8 pi over 6 KLP over gamma to 3 half, V plus 2, V plus 1 minus V plus 3, C minus of V is C plus of V minus 4. C 0 of V is minus C plus of V minus C minus of V. So we'll see that this is always explicitly smaller than 0. It's never 0. Okay, so we have the particular gravitational part of the Hamiltonian constraint. So far, we haven't considered any matter fields for the model. Right now, let us introduce the massless scalar field as a matter content, which will provide the evolution. And for that, just for simplicity, let us assume that we'll represent the scalar field in standard Schrödinger representation. Therefore, kinematical Hilbert space corresponding to matter field will be just standard space of square integrable function with standard measure d phi. Our basic variables will be again canonical variables phi and p phi, such that Poisson bracket between them is equal to 1. Our full kinematical Hilbert space will be just tensor product of gravitational kinematical Hilbert space, which was defined previously, and scalar field Hilbert space, which is this. Full Hamiltonian constraint will be just sum of Hamiltonian gravitational part, which was just derived, and the scalar one. Scalar one is 8 pi g times operator corresponding to the inverse volume times square of scalar field momentum raised to the operator. So we have again some non-triviality. We have to calculate what really what this inverse volume operator corresponds to in symmetry reduced theory. Again, we can employ the method developed by Professor Thiemann for operator, so-called inverse triad operator, which is absolute value of p to minus 1/2. Again, one can express it in terms of holonomies and triads. Let me just show how the formula looks like. So classically, again, we can express p to minus 1/2 as sine of p, then some physical constant. Trace over sum over k tau k. Holonomy times holonomy inverted with this time not with explicitly V, but with V volume to power 1/3. Again, this can be quantized where holonomy are raised to the holonomy operators, Poisson brackets are raised to commutators. And the final results are, after quite simple, however, quite long, quite boring calculations when all the components have to be gathered together. From here, it is just simple algebra. After promoting H to holonomy operators, Poisson brackets to commutators, and V to volume operator, one can get p to minus 1/2 okay, one can get operator p to minus 1/2, which acting on some state v, again, will give some function of v times eigenstate v. So this operator is, again, diagonal. This is also greater or equal 0. Therefore, we have symmetric non-negatively defined operator. We can take just cube of it. In consequence, to minus 3 half of V will be equal to 6 over 8 pi gamma LP square to 3 half times some function B, where B is some simple function of V again. What is important here is that if we take sufficiently large V, we can expand this formula, and we'll see, in fact, that P to minus 3 half of V will be equal to 1 over volume corresponding to V times V. So for sufficiently large, I mean not very large, just of the order of 2 or 4 V, this operator well approximates classical inverse volume. Now we can, again, gather together all the components. First of all, we see that since we are working in Schrödinger representation, momentum operator can be written as I h bar d by d phi. Of course, we still have this B function here. So we can divide both left and right hand side of this equation by function B. And the result will be some equation which is very similar to Klein-Gordon equation. On the left hand side, we have just second order derivative over the scalar field. On the right hand side, we have some negatively defined symmetric operator acting on wave function. Theta operator is related to gravitational constraint, which I wrote here, just by dividing every component, every function, by this B function defined here. This form of the constraint equation has very important consequences. Oops. Write it. So d phi square psi is equal to minus theta psi, where theta psi of V will be some C plus over B of V psi V plus 4 plus C 0 of V over B of V. C minus of V, RV V, psi V minus 4. So this will be our main equation, which we'll use. So the very form of this equation, namely that it is, it has just second order derivative on the left hand side, implies that we may think about as an evolution equation, exactly analogously to Klein-Gordon equation, and we can interpret value of the scalar field as time. So now we can switch from the constraint frozen formalism to standard evolution. And this answers one of the questions I asked at the very beginning. Namely, in this particular model, we have the natural emergent time. Okay, since gravitational part of the constraint was positive and symmetric on the Bohr compactification of the real line, our theta operator, which is just the result of division by function b, will be again symmetric and positively definite on space of the square integrable functions over Bohr compactification, but with measure modified by this b function. Okay, standard, the Bohr measure is a standard Haar measure on the Bohr compactification. So this is just Haar, this is Bohr measure, but it this is exactly equivalent to Haar measure. Sorry for the confusion. Okay, but let us look at the form of the operator. We see that it couples, for given psi of v, it couples only three points. V plus 4, v should be psi of v here, and psi of v minus 4. Therefore, the entire space, kinematical space, is divided onto superselected sectors which are sets of countable number of points separated by 4. We call them lattices. However, they are not explicitly lattices because we don't discretize any continuous operator. These are simply the sets invariant with respect to action of the evolution operator. So evolution on each of these lattices is completely independent. Therefore, we can just choose one of them and look at the states there. So far, the only matter content is just the scalar field. We don't have any weakly interacting fields, any fermions. Therefore, it's quite natural to assume symmetry, that our all the wave functions, all the states will be symmetric with respect to change of the orientation of V, which corresponded to change of the orientation of P, which corresponded to change of the orientation of physical triad, which was given by E. Wrong with this speaker or? Okay. So what we have to take into account is invariance with respect to the parity operator, which can be written as action on the function just inverts its argument. Therefore, we are taking not only these lattices, but pairs of them, which are related exactly by this parity inversion. Therefore, our physical states will be supported on the following sets, where n is the integer number. The physical Hilbert space can be constructed using the standard Friedrich method. First of all, we have to find the spectrum of the evolution operator. So how the eigenfunctions of this operator look like? I will denote them by small psi. Since it allows positively definite operator, the eigenvalue will be just omega square. And then if we again look at the form of the operator, which is here, we see that this equation for the eigenfunction is in fact difference equation of the second order. To solve it, we have to specify two points on some v and v plus 4, both lying on particular sublattice plus minus epsilon, where sublattice plus minus epsilon corresponded just to single sign of the epsilon. Unfortunately, we have to solve this equation for each of these sublattices plus minus independently. And we have to provide initial data on two points. Therefore, we will have twofold degeneracy for each sublattice. However, then we should expect fourfold degeneracy for each lattice L epsilon, which is the union of those two. However, we assumed the symmetry. Therefore, once we calculate the function on one lattice, say plus epsilon, the parity inversion operator already provides us the eigenfunction on the second lattice. Therefore, our degeneracy is still just twofold. For two particular values of the epsilon, 0 and 2, our lattice, single lattice, say plus epsilon, is invariant with respect to the parity inversion. If we reflect the function, we end up on the same lattice. Therefore, the symmetry requirement imposes additional constraint on this equation. For example, for epsilon equal to 0, we have omega square psi of 0 equal to some c plus of 0 by I just put this b of 0 here. Psi 4 plus c plus of c 0 of 0 psi of 0 plus psi minus of 0 psi minus 4. Point is that this, due to symmetry, is supposed to be equal to psi 4. Therefore, we have the equation which couples psi 0 and psi 4. This is an additional constraint. In consequence, since all the coefficients here are real, we have just one-dimensional eigenspaces. Moreover, if we provide some initial data, say psi of 0, the phase of the particular values of eigenfunction at given points will be constant. Therefore, we can fix it to be real. Now, this result, which I'm going to present, is the result of numerical investigation. One cannot easily calculate it analytically. But just by inspection, one can show that these eigenfunctions are Dirac delta normalizable. And they have this property for all possible, of course, positive values of omega square. In consequence, entire spectrum of theta will consist of all the omega squares. And the situation will be very similar to Klein-Gordon equation. We can introduce exactly this Dirac delta normalized base of symmetric eigenfunctions, which I called EKS, which be enumerated by k's related to omegas by the following relation. And due to this twofold degeneracy for generic lattices, k can take value positive or negative for given omega. Also, as in Klein-Gordon case, we have superselected sectors of positive and negative frequency solutions. Therefore, we can choose just positive frequency ones. And our physical states will be constructed as follows. This will be just integral of from minus infinity to plus infinity over decay. Something called, as far as I remember, spectral profile, some function of k, times particular eigenfunction, times e to I omega phi, which is responsible for the evolution. Physical inner product, again, on this space will be given just by the sum over the lattice, times this function b it's just the same function, b tilde equal to b. Okay. And maybe I will stop here and say something about the Dirac observables during the next lecture. Yes. At the very beginning, we just tried with ordering the original ordering where both these signs were here. So it was sine square. This wasn't here. And all the results, all the physics extraction, construction of the semi-classical states went exactly. I mean, results were almost identical. Within the numerical error, one couldn't really see the differences. There was some difference in the spectrum operator because there was some kind of mass gap. There was lowest value of the frequency, which was a little bit probably. I mean, the lowest eigenvalue was, as far as I remember, shifted a little bit down. So the operator wasn't positively definite anymore. However, it's not really a problem because on the left-hand side, we have something which is negatively definite. Therefore, it, again, automatically extracts just positive part of the theta evolution operator. But all the results were or indistinguishable from the results for this factor ordering.
But it's just another
another ordering. But,
yeah, that's
just
right.
Trying to ask what about uniqueness of, I mean, maybe one could find, okay. But another sort of question concerns this, let's say, evolution. Isn't it an abuse of language calling that an evolution of parameter?
Value of the scalar field? Value of the scalar field. It's not. Physically, it's just the scalar field. It's the value of the field. But here, due to the particular form of the constraint equation, it can serve as internal time. So why should be it abuse of the language?
Maybe we shouldn't call it time, but just evolution parameter.
Okay. But it still serves the same role.
And how far do we do these, the procedure you just carried out seems to me to depend heavily on the fact that, the scalar field is massless.
That's right.
Have a massive scalar field?
The question is not answered yet in details. What one can do, one can try to introduce some another variable, to find some another variable which at least on classical level will change monotonously with time, then it is a chance that for quantum evolution, this variable will serve as some kind of good evolution parameter. Other possibility, more general, is to use the relations between observables. Just completely forget about the time. Just try to define some Dirac observables and calculate the correlation between expectation values.
I have a question. Could you again explain why you impose this parity condition?
Because we don't have any fermions here, so in particular, we don't have any parity breaking interactions. Therefore, it was some kind of natural assumption here. It's not absolutely necessary, however. One can proceed without it, obtaining more or less the same results. I mean, no. Then the wave functions won't be symmetric, but dynamics will be the same.
At this example, take a real half line, and take a C infinity of real half line. Then you can define for this real half line coproduct in the following manner: take a function, apply the coproduct, and evaluate on the point tt prime, then by definition it is a function applied to the sum. You can check that this is co-associated, but of course this is not a group. This is just a semi-group. So we need more structure to define a quantum group. Co-algebra, of course, is not enough. And just by definition, well, in a sense, by definition, when you have a morphism from A to compact operators, then you have a map from A to B of H, because it is a map from A to multipliers of compact operators, which is B of H. So this set is a, by definition, set of representation of A on H. So if you have an element of this morphism, then A knows how to act on a Hilbert space H. So, maybe I will skip it. Not very. Now we can go to the definition of there was a little bit of technicality, but now we can go to the definition of coproduct for our sister algebra AS. But to introduce it, we need more structure. We will see in a moment, but it is not so easy to define it, but it exists. And how it is defined. So let us come back for a while to understand it. Let us come back for a while to the classical case. So if G is a locally compact group, so for instance, the Lorentz group, then H is a square of G. Then you can introduce very, very important object, which is called Katz-Takasaki operator. And this is V, this is a map. This is a bounded operator which acts on L square of G times L square of G. And what is the definition? So this map acts on L square function of two variables. And the result is a L square function of two variables. And the definition, you have here the definition. This is a function of two variables, and you apply it to GG prime. By definition, it is a function F applied to G times G prime, comma G prime. So this operator is unitary operator. You can easily find the inverse, and inverse coincide with a star of this operator. And for instance, one of the most important property of this operator is that it implements coproduct. It implements coproduct for C infinity of G. How it happens? You can just see that this coproduct defined here just by, well, F, I hope that now you already remember the definition of coproduct. So you can just check that if you compose V with F tensor 1, V star, then this is just a bounded operator acting on L square of G times L square of G. So the result is a function function of two variables, delta of F, which is treated as operator acting on L square of G times L square of G. So this is one of the most important property of this operator. It implements, yes?
No, I'm not sure I understand what it means to put the V star in front of it. Like, well, I don't understand the
So V is, why it is reasonable to write such a, okay. So V is a map from, which act, V is a bounded map from L square of G times L square of G. Maybe I should write here just L square of G. So V star is also map, is a bounded operator acting on L square of G times L square of G. So this is bounded operator acting on L square of G times G.
So, but is it acting this way?
Doesn't matter, but you can compose it with I don't understand. We can compose it with such an operator. This is operator acting, and then you can compose it with the result. You compose result with V, and you just check that the result, that V implements coproduct. And now,
F acts by multiplication
on the first copy of L square of G. Well, we have more properties, maybe, but the strategy of introducing coproduct on AS, which was defined by this invariant elements for the deformed action, is that you should find the different operator which would implement your coproduct. So this is the strategy. Now I will go. Well, we have more important properties because, when omega is a density matrix, then you can, so you have trace class operator, you can take, if rho is a trace class operator acting on L square of G, then you can define functional trace rho, and here you put operators, and you can, well, you should know it from quantum physics. Then when you do it, V has two legs. One is acting at this copy of L square of G, the other one is acting at this copy of L square of G. But it turns out that if you apply omega to the first leg of V, then the result is an element of C infinity of G. And what is the result? So omega times identity of V is a function, so you should be able to give it, to apply it to G. And you can check that this is trace of rho times shift from the right, so this is operator acting on L square of G, shift from the right, multiply by your trace class operator, you take a trace. So this is a this is. Omega rho, omega which corresponds to this. So omega is just, omega rho is this functional.
You just take a function from this L squared space, form a multiplication operator using this function, and if this function is integrable to one, this is a density matrix, yeah? Because it acts by multiplication. No.
Sorry. No. Sorry. Omega is a functional, is a trace, is a normal, how to turn it off? Is a normal functional. It is a omega is a normal functional, and and V is an operator. So omega is a functional which can be applied to operators. You can take trace of operator. If rho is a trace class, then this is a finite number. And now V has two legs. It is operators of the form A1 tensor A2. And you can apply that omega rho to the first leg of V. And well, this gives you a function. Well, and you can check that this function is given by this formula. You take right shifts along the group, not the subgroup, but the group, and take a trace, and this is your vanishing at infinity function. Yes?
Could you explain what you mean by trace class?
The operator which has a finite trace on a Hilbert, which is infinite dimensional. I should finish now. Break. Okay. Okay, so okay, so break. So now it's very technical, maybe too technical. Okay.